It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. The parable of the prodigal son, for which I hope it will not be your first time to hear it, I need to tell you the story about the service for this morning and for next week. I'm looking for the place to enter the contest because I think I have a good chance of winning the contest for procrastinators. 15 years ago, I decided that I would write soliloquies for all four characters in the prodigal son story. And in 1988, I wrote a soliloquy for the older brother. That was the easiest to write. And then in 1990, I thought it would be fun to write a soliloquy for the fatted calf. So I did that. And that was the end of it. And now, 13 years later, I finally decided to finish them because of a fluke in the schedule. We were supposed to have had a guest speaker next Sunday, and when we didn't get a guest speaker for next Sunday, I had 2 weeks in a row to work on and decided this would be a good time to finally get back to that project I'd set for myself 15 years ago to finish writing soliloquies for the characters in the prodigal son story. As I got into writing them, and I had to write the father and the prodigal son together because they play off each other, I realized the other reason I put them off so long ago was because these two are the hardest and the story takes an unexpected turn with these two. You need to know a little bit about what a parable is. A parable is a very special kind of literature. It's not an example story. A parable is not saying, here's what you should do if you're in this situation. That's too easy. A parable is not an allegory. It isn't saying life is like this. You know life is like this when you get into it because a parable gets into you. What a parable does that no other kind of story does as powerfully is that it tricks you into coming into the story, and then you discover that if you understand the story, it will absolutely subvert your world. It will challenge the foundations of your world. This is why prophets who teach in parables are so apt to get strung up. And the parable of the prodigal son takes that turn in the characters of the father and the prodigal son. Now, I'll read you this story. It's one of the finest parables I think ever written. It occurs in the New Testament only in the Gospel of Luke, though the New Testament scholars that I respect, the ones in the Jesus Seminar, are unanimous that this is a story that would be authentic to Jesus. In other words, it was either written by Jesus or somebody who thought just like him, because it's like the message of all of his other parables. I'll read you the story. There was a man who had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the share of property that falls to me. In other words, he demanded his inheritance in advance. And the father divided his living between them. Not many days later, the younger son gathered all he had and took his journey into a far country. And there he squandered his property in loose living. And when he had spent everything, a great famine arose in that country, and he began to be hungry. So he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, who sent him into his fields to feed the swine. And he would gladly have eaten the pods that the swine ate, for no one gave him anything. But when he came to himself, he said, How many of my father's hired servants have bread enough and to spare, but I'm dying of hunger here. I'll go to my father, and I will say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Treat me as one of your hired servants." And he arose, and he went back home to his father. But while he was yet at a distance, his father saw him and had compassion. And he ran and embraced him and kissed him. And the son said to him, "Father, I have sinned against heaven and before you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quickly bring the best robe and put it on him, and put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet, and bring the fatted calf and kill it, and let us eat and make merry. For this my son was dead, and he is alive again. He was lost and is found." And they began to make merry. In the center of our service and the center of our lives, let's bring it down to make room for the silences in our lives. You may use these first moments to light candles of memory and hope, or just sit quietly remembering who you are and why you are here. Fear embarrasses us, so we wait for our chance, knowing their weak spots better than anyone because they trust us. When the chance comes, we jump at it. They're embarrassed. We feel vindicated. And the game goes on. We can't score points on the boss, so we bring the frustration home, waiting for someone more vulnerable. Then we're on our guard, for we know they'll try to get even. How many times in our life has this kind of behavior described us? There's no one here who doesn't recognize it. Giving people their due, making sure they get what they deserve, not letting them off the hook, showing them that what goes around comes around by God, while hoping we never get the same kind of humiliating justice visited upon us. It is this world, this very recognizable human world, into which we bring the harder lessons of religion, the voices of our more tender mercies. It is of this world and of ourselves that we ask whether this is the highest road we can travel, the most we can expect of ourselves or others. We do it in so many ways. Christians ask, "What would Jesus do?" Jews say we are commanded to love God with all our heart and soul and to love our neighbor as ourself, whether we feel like it or not. Buddhists ask whether we are acting from out of the Buddha seed within us and recognizing the Buddha seed within others. Confucius would ask whether our actions let our society move with more grace or less. And the Tao Te Ching says that the great secret of life is realizing that a bad person is a good person's job, and a good person is a bad person's teacher. When we look anywhere that people have tried to take seriously the human condition, we find that most of the suffering we experience comes from the way we treat one another, and the ways in which we get even for the ways others have treated us. Let us remind ourselves once more of things we have always known: that two wrongs don't make a right, that peace usually begins through the actions of the bigger person, the person of better character. Let us remind ourselves that understanding is more grown up than undermining, and that when we score points against another by demeaning them, those points are taken out of our own moral account. And then let us ask, even in those cases where a hard justice is due, whether we, our relationships, and our world are better served by justice or by compassion. By giving someone what they deserve, or by forgiving their trespasses in the faith that they are good people doing the best they can and that they could use a break rather than a breaking. For as wise preachers have said forever, it is by giving that we can receive, by understanding that we can be understood, and by forgiving that we may be forgiven. It is hard to do so. Let us find the strength within, among, and around us to do what is most compassionate when it would be so much easier merely to do what is right. We seek the moral strength for these higher callings, and we pray for the courage not to do what is right, but to do what is best. We offer these prayers with honest hearts and a deep gratitude for the life which has been given us. Amen. Do you really wonder why I did it? I'm not sure I know. Maybe I wondered what God would want me to do, or remembered that I'm his father and he's my son. Maybe I felt some guilt, wondered what I might have done differently, how I might have been a better father, and what role my own failures have played in his foolish decision. Some people say we're on our own, that our mistakes are all our own and we must pay for them. Most of my friends say that. I don't know what they mean. In my whole life, I have never felt alone. Everything I've done as part of a family, a people, relationships, a whole human race. You may say these connections are invisible. I say they have sustained me my entire life. We're not alone. If we're alone, it's everyone's loss and everyone's failure. We're not alone. Who could say such a thing? I think of how awful he looked when he returned. What sad, desperate eyes he had. I had never seen him. So completely undone. So hopeless, so dead. He didn't act like he was my son. He didn't even feel he had the right to be my son. My neighbors all say he asked for it. He demanded his inheritance in advance. He demanded that I give him the money he would have received if he'd waited until I died. It's one of our rules. Sons can do that. It almost never happens, of course, because it cuts all ties to the family forevermore. They may never again make any claims on their family if they do this. Yet my son did it, and he could. It's the law. But to let an impersonal law rip the warmth of my son not only out of my home but out of my heart? Who could allow such a thing? No one I would want to know, and no one I would want to be. Maybe it was just little things. When I looked in his eyes, I saw his whole life there. I remembered the day he came into the world, that wrinkled little red baby. And I remembered all the growing up years and all the million little memories that a father has. Silly things, most of them. You know, the things parents notice and won't forget. One that came to me so strongly was I remembered how when he was young, he would be so terrified when it thundered. Every time it thundered, he would get scared. And finally, I said, "Oh, don't worry about it." I said, "That's just God. He's upset. He's worried about something. But don't worry about him. He'll get over it. You'll see by tomorrow morning, he'll be all sunny again." That was our little joke. We must have played that thunder joke 100 times as he grew up. I remember just a few years ago, it's so funny that it seems like yesterday. We were out in the field working, trying to get the animals fed before the rain, and it thundered. It just thundered something fierce, and I watched him. And for a while, he ignored it. And then suddenly he looked up from his work, and he shouted, "Hey, Lord, we've got troubles too, but you don't hear us griping. Get over it." One of my neighbors was with us, and he said afterward that my son had been blasphemous toward God. And I thought, what a silly thing to say. That wasn't blasphemy. That was love talk. I don't want a relationship with God at the cold distance of an impersonal law. I want our hearts joined. If I'm going to know my God, I'm going to know him through love talk. I was so proud of my boy to have learned how to talk love talk to God. He was such a burst of life. He was so different from his older brother. That the older one has always been so serious, so responsible, all work. He's so good. He's such a decent person. And he is so rule-bound. I keep hoping he'll make space in his life for a little gentleness, that he'll find a way to replace some compulsion with compassion. But the younger boy, he's almost the opposite. He worked. He did his share. But for him, it was never about the work. For him, life was always about joy, not jobs. Every year at the Harvest Festival, he would ask why we couldn't do this much more often. Why we had to make work common and joy rare. I would explain that joy is all the richer because it's so rare. That life has a rhythm like nature, that's why we rest on the Sabbath, but not in between. That was God's idea, you know, and it's a good one. I've told him so. So I'd tell my son, that's why we just have harvest festivals once a year. But he never bought it. He didn't complain about his work. Maybe he should have. I think he just kept it inside until it exploded in that awful decision to leave. My neighbors, my friends all came over after he left and said, good riddance, that any son who would demand his inheritance in advance was no real son anyway, that I was better off without him, like he was a bad investment. But if you're a parent, you know that when he left, it broke my heart. I think I know what he wanted. He wanted some respite from life. Work, duty, responsibility, they're so important, but they're not enough. Where's the softness to life? Where's the humanity? When do our hearts touch? Only once a year at a harvest feast? That's not enough joy. I think my son was freezing to death here. And maybe some of that was my fault. I don't know. But how do you bring all that into the real world? The world you and I know of work and duty, how do you bring compassion and love into that? It doesn't fit. It only fits around the edges. It doesn't fit at the center. At the center, there's always more work to do. My son wanted a different kind of world with more life to it, more connections, more of a sense of family, something better than just work and duty, something that might transform our duties into activities that nourish our souls. That's what he wanted. And all these things were in my mind when he returned. Where's there room for love in the world? How can we interrupt the endless cycles of work and responsibility to make a more gentle home, not only for the human spirit, but for the Spirit of God? We seem to see people only in terms of what they do or earn. My servants respect and fear me, not because they think I'm a superior person, only because I control the money, the power, their jobs. Where's the human relationship? Why can't we know each other as brothers and sisters, as children of God? That could transform the whole world if it ever took root. I know how my son felt. I miss it too. I can't create the new kind of world. One person can't do that alone. Not a father, not even a God. But I thought maybe I could start it somehow by acting out of a different place. So I did it. It was only a start. I don't know what will come of it. Maybe nothing. But I do know that the only way the world can be transformed is through people having the vision and the courage to act from a different kind of center. In some ways, I don't envy my son. If you think about it, my act was easy. He has to live with it now, among people who don't understand and don't like him. My older boy wants an explanation. My friends and neighbors want an explanation. They say I owe them one. They say it's a slap in my older son's face for his dutiful work. And they say it's a slap in their face too, that it has planted irresponsible ideas in their own son's heads. There's this whole system of work, duty, responsibility, justice, and honor, they say, and I've insulted it, maybe threatened it. If the failure to do your duty can be so easily forgiven, they say, then where is its necessity? And how will the world still hold it together? I don't know. Did I have to have a whole philosophical system in place to act out of? Couldn't I just love my son and act out of that? I'm a father, not a philosopher. I don't understand all their concerns. I'm just a father who lost his son. And found him again and threw a party to celebrate it. Wouldn't it be a better world if more people did this? Maybe there are implications to what I did. Perhaps this act of mine can't stand alone. I wonder how my younger son feels. Don't you think he'd be grateful, or is there more to that too? I don't know. The rabbis say that the whole substance of the Torah can be summed up simply by saying that we are to love God with our heart and soul and to love our neighbors as ourselves. But if you owe all that to your neighbor, what do you owe your son? You must owe at least as much. Don't you owe even more? And even if you don't owe it, can't you give it? Can't you just give more than someone deserves? Can't you do that? I don't know. I just acted out of love for my son. Once he was dead to me and gone, now he's alive again and he's here. Isn't that enough? I'm a father, not a philosopher. Figuring out the rest of it's up to you. Look, I did what I could. I planted a seed in the hope that it might someday grow into something that could give more shelter for people I love. It wasn't enough, but I did what I could to move my part of the world toward compassion and love, away from functional relationships and toward loving relationships, you know? I did what I could. And you, what kind of world are you creating with your actions? What are you doing?